Operation Food Secure is a joint initiative with the United Way of Greater Topeka, the Topeka Rescue Mission, and the City of Topeka Department of Neighborhood Relations. Earlier this year, Congress authorized relief funding to USDA in order to provide stabilization through food. And so USDA rolled out a program called Farmers to Families Food Box. And that program takes food that was originally intended for a other destination, like maybe Applebee's when Applebee's was closed down, or if we're looking at football, the Big 12 or Big 10 or the Pac-12, where we're not sure what's going to happen with those games. All of that food that's being grown or that was grown all of a sudden didn't have a destination anymore. And so across the country, supply chains are being rerouted and that food is being rescued and given to groups like ours in order to provide relief to individuals who are experiencing food insecurity. So we took this project on at the end of June. And so TRM has kind of the infrastructure to hold the food. We use refrigerated trailers that have been donated by Mars and US Foods and Reesers. We are soon going to be moving into a refrigerated space. And we have been taking the food that USDA has been giving us and then, you know, trying to really be strategic about redistributing that in the community. So the way that we are doing that, what we're discovering in the area, not just Topeka, but the surrounding counties, is that there are a lot of folks who are not traditionally used to experiencing a level of need or food insecurity that they have before. So maybe it's because they were furloughed for an amount of time, they're just getting back to work now, they may have been laid off, they may have had to change the amount of shifts they could take because they've got kids at home they've got to look after. So we're seeing a huge influx of people who have not necessarily experienced hunger in our community quite in this type of way before. And then on top of that, an interesting result of the pandemic has been that grocery store prices have actually been spiking. Right now it's about a 5.6% increase. So that's the largest increase in a decade nearly of food prices. And we're seeing variance depending on the product. For instance, meat is about 25% higher in price. And then fruit and vegetables are about 2 to 3% higher. So that is causing other types of disruption for folks in our community who are low income, who spend a greater percentage of their income on purchasing food. So we've kind of got some different needs popping up in the community that we have discovered. And so with everyone that is experiencing food insecurity, we wanted to be strategic. We've been in close conversations with harvesters, and we really respect what they do and didn't want to necessarily just copycat their truck-to-trunk model. And so we kind of came up with a site model for distributing food. This is taking a bite-size and more strategic geographical approach. It's empowering neighbors to help neighbors and thinking more about stabilizing the community from the neighborhoods out. So we have asked different groups since the end of June to step up and take responsibility and ownership of providing these food boxes that we're getting for free from USDA to their geographic area. So that can be a neighborhood improvement association or a neighborhood association. We've got neighborhood churches who are wanting to serve the people who are in their surrounding areas. We also work with agencies like Boys and Girls Club and Vallejo, who utilize the food to serve their clients and create a touch point there. So we are kind of taking different approaches to get the food the last mile from our refrigerators into neighborhoods. When Monique asked me to kind of give an update, I thought I would just kind of lay that out for you guys and kind of also pitch to you guys that this is more than just an immediate relief as well. Of course, USDA, you know, doesn't want this food to go to waste, doesn't want food to go in the ground. But in taking a long-term approach that's relationship-based with a site captain that is getting to know the people in their neighborhood and their needs, there is potential for strengthening a community or strengthening a neighborhood. So the pitch here on my end would be, if you guys have areas that you see need, it may not be a traditional low income area. It could be an area that you would consider middle class, but there are neighbors who are really struggling in this time. Potentially looking at taking some ownership and being a site captain, getting to know the needs of your neighbors, and becoming a site for food distribution. Like I said, we've got neighborhood associations and neighborhood improvement associations. We've got clubs and associations taking this on. Churches, the kind of common denominator is people who are looking to serve their neighbors in a strategic way beyond just handing them the box of food. So I'm open to questions. I know that you guys have an agenda, but if there are questions, I'd be happy to take them. And if you guys are interested, I will drop my email address in the chat and the webpage as well for the program, so that you guys can take a look. We've got an FAQ on the webpage as well. And we also have a place for people to self-refer. So if they need food, we have a process to make sure we get them matched up if there's someone in their area.
This is Trisha Miller. I have a question. I can only do phones, but I can't see anything that's being put out on anything. My question with these boxes, don't you have to have a refrigeration place to put them? So like if an NIA wanted to do it, but they don't have a place to be storing these boxes to keep them cold.
They have to have a place to keep them cold, correct? Correct. So we store them in our refrigeration units. And then when you guys pick up, the requirement is that they stay, if they're out of refrigeration, they're only out for about 2 hours. So we found most of our groups can get rid of the boxes in 2 hours, but we will store them in refrigeration here at the mission until that there's a time that works for y'all to pick up.
Okay.
Marissa, we have a question in the chat from Donna Ray Pearson. She's wanting to know, how big are the boxes?
That's also a great question. So on September 1, USDA is going to up the sizes of the boxes. Right now, they're about 20 to 25 pounds. They're going to go from 30 to 40 pounds. That's because they are going to include pre-cooked meat as a requirement. And so that's huge, we think, because meat prices are particularly high and protein is really important for nutrition. They also will be accompanied by a gallon of milk, which in June and July and August, they were not necessarily, they didn't have to be paired with.
We have another question from the chat. How frequently are they distributed, and does the coordinator have to pick them up?
That's a great question. Most of our sites currently distribute on a weekly basis. And then as far as coordinator picking them up, well, let me finish that. We do have some sites that do every other week. And we have a couple of sites out in our outlying counties that do like a once a month. They're more the truck to trunk model, and they are more thinking about supplementing where Harvesters doesn't have coverage. So in case you hear of kind of some variants. We have some coordinators that do the pickup, but we allow coordinators to recruit volunteers for their team. The site captains will maybe recruit someone to come pick up with the truck or their vehicle. So that is up to you and the team that you assemble. And we can kind of also help provide some suggestions on getting that taken care of. Oh, a good thing I would add too is we have volunteers that load your car, so you don't get out of your car, social distance safe, everyone's masked up, so you don't have to worry about lifting that.
Do you have lists that are already out there where these drop-off places are?
We do. We don't widely advertise them because it is not like Harvesters where the whole community is invited to come and pick up. It's supposed to be bite-sized, neighborhood, neighbor to neighbor, and filling the gap. Okay. So it's on the site captains to share with their neighbors and communicate. I would say word travels pretty quick amongst neighbors. And so we oftentimes, for example, we had an NIA on the east side do a distribution this week. They took 50 boxes and they got rid of them in an hour because word traveled pretty quick from neighbor to neighbor.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Latoria, is this all information going to be in the minutes?
Yes, this recording will actually be posted to the website after the meeting, and I'll send a link out to everyone when it's posted.
Right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Marissa. We'll be sure to provide everyone with your information, and hopefully you'll get tons of calls of people who are able to help our neighbors. So much for your time.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
So I think James is getting back on the call for the next line item in the agenda. So as soon as he pops back on, we'll move forward with that. Thanks, Marissa.
Okay, hold on. It's switching over right now. I apologize. All right. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. I'm having difficulties today. So our next speaker is going to be Topeka Moms Man Action with Danielle, Hannah, and Ann. One of those names I know I'm going to butcher really badly, so I'm just going to say their first names. So with that, I'd like to welcome them. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Hannah, and my name is Hannah Schumacher, and Anne and I are here this evening. Danielle is actually at another meeting. Thank you. I can screen share in a moment, too. But I just wanted to take a minute to introduce myself, and then if Anne would like to introduce herself before we start. Again, my name is Hannah, and I've been a Topekan since 2011. I am a former educator, a mom of three, a wife of a native Topekan, and currently a stay-at-home mom. Anne, would you like to introduce yourself while I start screen sharing?
Sure. I'm Anne Williamson. I've been a Topekan since 2002. I was a journalist for a long time at the Capital Journal and currently staying home with my two children.
Okay. Is everybody able to see the presentation? Those with the video? Thank you for the thumbs up. Appreciate it.
Are you going to explain everything that's on the video? I'm just on the phone. I can't see anything.
Yes, we will. We're just getting it started going. So Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is a grassroots nonpartisan movement that's fighting for public safety measures that protect people from gun violence and keep families safe. It was started by a woman named Shannon Watts after the Sandy Hook school shooting in 2012. And here in Kansas, we have 11 groups throughout our state, and they're listed here as well. And here in Topeka, we've been a group since 2017. And prior to that, there were a few key, very active members, just no established group. And then what are we all about? We're part of the gun violence prevention movement, and we include what we say as mothers and others. And what we really mean by mothers and others is mothers, fathers, citizens, students, survivors, and people who want to make a difference in their community. And when we refer to survivors, we're talking about anyone who has been impacted by gun violence. And that could mean a person maybe witnessed an instance of gun violence, survived an instance of gun violence, or had someone they loved taken by gun violence. We're a group that supports the Second Amendment right, but we know that it goes hand in hand with common sense gun laws and a culture of gun safety. And when we talk about common sense gun laws, we're talking about things like universal background checks, red flag laws, and disarming convicted domestic abusers. And when we're talking about a culture of gun safety, we're talking about, if you're a gun owner, making sure that you store your gun locked and unloaded, and you don't leave your gun in cars where it's easily accessible to others. We also partner within our community to foster diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we are anti-gun violence, not anti-gun. Our group here in Topeka includes volunteers who are parents, grandparents, survivors of gun violence, students, gun owners, and non-gun owners. So we do this work because every day in America, over 100 Americans are killed by gun violence, and countless more are wounded. Here in Topeka in 2020 alone so far, there have been 19 homicides. And in Kansas, the average is 386 gun deaths a year. In addition, we know that children in the United States, ages 18 and under, about 1,500 of them are killed with guns, and nearly 600 more are die by suicide with a gun each year. And we also know that our communities of color are disproportionately impacted by gun violence compared to their white counterparts. And we also know that every instance of gun violence in a community has far-reaching effects that don't always make the headlines. For example, according to the impact of gun violence on children and teens by the Everytown Research and Policy Institute, children who witness gun violence are more likely, children and teens, excuse me, are more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, suffer from illnesses like depression and anxiety and PTSD, resort to aggressive or violent behavior themselves, and engage in criminal activity. It can also erode physical health. It's been found that children exposed to gun violence spend less time playing and being physically active. And it also impacts school performance. They've been shown to have lower grades and more absences from school, as well as lower test scores and lower rates of high school graduation. So how do we support this work? We support responsible gun ownership, gun ownership, by working to keep guns out of the wrong hands and supporting a culture of gun safety. We advocate for the following evidence-based strategies to keep our families and communities safe. One thing we do is advocate for keeping guns out of the wrong hands by supporting background check systems that close the loopholes, such as allowing people to buy guns without background checks. We support protecting kids and communities by supporting red flag laws. And those are laws which allow family and law enforcement to intervene when a person is a threat to themselves or others before deadly tragedies involving firearms occur. We also work to address our unique domestic abuse problem by supporting legislation such as things called the boyfriend loophole, which prohibits convicted domestic abusers from keeping weapons they have or purchasing new ones or obtaining new ones. And we also work at combating daily gun violence. And we do that by supporting research, local law enforcement, and community organizations and groups working towards that goal. And when we think about that one, in supporting police, we know that it might look different than traditional policing, because we know that sometimes aspects of traditional policing hasn't worked for the most vulnerable members of our community. So why are we here? We know that change happens when communities and groups come together and work together. And we are a small but mighty group, and we're committed to putting in hard work and collaborating with other groups in our community and individuals to work towards ending gun violence in all its forms. We also know that crime prevention through environmental design is a strategy through neighborhood improvement projects that are linked to reducing crime in neighborhoods and improving physical space, but also getting neighbors to work together to build relationships and accountability with their communities. And the last reason why we're here, of course, is that we know that Topeka is not an exception to violence. These next few slides, and I'll kind of describe them for people just on the phone or unable to view video, show some data related to Shawnee County and Topeka. And this first one is the premature death rate of Shawnee County, and it's shown in its years of potential life lost. And there's a graph that is showing Shawnee County, Kansas, and the United States. And what this graph is showing is that Topekans die earlier than their fellow Kansans and nationally. And at the bottom, there are some rankings by year, and it shows that in 2016, Shawnee County was ranked 43rd out of 105 Kansas counties in the years of potential life lost. But in 2019, that ranking jumped up to 78 out of 105, which is the worst ranking of years of potential life lost here in Shawnee County. And in addition to this, we know that Black men in Shawnee County die 12 years earlier than their white counterparts. This next slide shows causes of that change in years of life lost. And if you notice, the homicide rate and suicide rates have drastically increased in their contribution, with homicide of 142% and suicide at 69%. And then this next slide shows some socioeconomic factors and rankings in Shawnee County in 2018 and 2019. And you can see our ranking increased, which really means got worse or dropped, from 2018 to 2019 to 73 out of 105 counties. So how are we involved in our community and our state? There are four major areas that volunteers with Moms Demand Action work on locally and at the state level. We work on legislation, community education, partnerships, and with survivors. Our state legislative team keeps us up to date each legislative session on bills related to gun violence, and then we do what we can with calls, texts, tweets, showing up at the state house to make sure our voices are heard on those bills. There's also a handful of us here in Topeka who are trained to register voters. A variety of us also serve on other community organizations and positions and different volunteering aspects in our community. We also spread the Be Smart message, which we'll talk more about here in a minute, and hand out free gun locks to the community by attending different community events, giving Be Smart presentations, and distributing handouts and materials in the community. Currently, we have Be Smart information at the Cotton O'Neill Pediatric Care locations, at the pediatric floor at Stormont Vale and in the city's Holiday Building downtown. We also have a survivors network, which is composed of survivors who again includes people who have either witnessed, been threatened by, or survived or lost someone that they love from gun violence. And this is a nationwide organization that provides resources, learning experiences, gatherings to survivors of gun violence. And we have a couple of really strong survivor members here in our community as well. Do we have time for like a 3-minute Be Smart video? I think that's probably.
Yes, ma'am, you've got about 7 minutes left.
Perfect. I think it's about 3 minutes, yep.
I'm not getting the audio for the video. Okay. No? Okay.
Would it be possible to include the link for this video in the email after the fact?
Because yes, was the audio not working?
No, yes. It's not coming across at all.
Yes, we can include that at the end and then people can watch it on their own if they'd like. Okay, so give me a second to get back where we were. Oops. Okay, so Be Smart is our community education program. Hold on a second. I think I didn't stop the video. Did that stop? Okay, sorry. Okay, excuse the interruption. So Be Smart is our community education program, and it's an acronym to help adults remember and learn how to safely store guns to prevent injuries in children and others in the community. So the S in SMART stands for secure, and that means to secure your guns in your homes and vehicles. And we're talking about that again, we're talking about those guns locked and unloaded. And M stands for model, modeling responsible behavior around guns. And then A stands for ask. And with that, we want people to ask about the presence of unsecured guns in other homes. Like, for example, if, and I know this might not be happening right now because of COVID, but if you have kids or teenagers and they're participating in sleepovers or playtime or play dates, just making sure you ask if there's guns in the home that they're going to, and if there are, how are they stored? The R stands for recognize the role of guns in suicide. Currently, there's an 85% fatality rate when we're talking about gun suicide. So it's important to recognize that connection. And then T stands for tell your friends to be smart and just spread the message amongst those you know. So how can you help, or how can we all work together towards this goal? One thing that we can do is partner with local groups or each other, working towards a common goal of reducing gun violence in our community. Another thing, if you're interested, is you can text the word join to the number 64433. And by doing that, you'll be prompted to sign up like with your email or phone number, address, and that will put you on the information list for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Additionally, we encourage people to vote and also vote for Gun Sense candidates. And if you're interested in seeing who your Gun Sense candidates are, you can go to the website gunsensevoter.org and put in your address, and it'll put up a list of candidates in your elections who are Gun Sense candidates. And then we encourage everybody to use your voice and engage in your community, working towards common goals. And then also to remember to be a responsible gun owner by being smart and telling your friends as well. And then I'm not quite sure how we are on time, but that's the information we had to share for today. So if anybody has any questions or anything, we are here for that.
Have you guys ever thought about partnering with the Eddie Eagle Gun Safety Program? It used to be really big in schools. I don't know if it is around here or not.
Since we have the Be Smart kind of community education program, we haven't really partnered with that. And honestly, I don't know if that's still a part of school curriculum or not. So we haven't looked into that. But we have looked into partnering with our local school districts about getting information out about safe gun storage and talking to kids about guns and things like that.
I would suggest maybe speaking to the people over at Community Action Head Start as well. And, because there are a number of kids within those programs that come from low to moderate income backgrounds, live in low to moderate income neighborhoods, and there may be a partnership opportunity there as well.
Thank you. That's good. That's a good suggestion. And we also are open to partnering with any groups within the community who would like more information or have a desire to work towards a goal in their neighborhood or another group that they might be involved in as well. Any other questions?
Hannah and Ann, thank you for the presentation this evening. We appreciate your work and your commitment to our community. We'll be sure to share both the presentation again with the group and your contact information. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You guys have a great rest of the meeting.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, ladies, very much. We really appreciate the information. We're going to move on to our next scheduled item, which is a Q&A with Mr. Trout, our city manager. Everybody, I would just like to remind you to please be respectful of Mr. Trout and his time. I understand that we have questions. There are some questions that have already been emailed to Mr. Trout, so hopefully he has some more in-depth responses to some of those questions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Trout.
All right. Well, good evening. Happy to be here. It's been too long, I would say, from the beginning since we've last been together. Been a lot that's been going on over the last 6-8 months, but with that, happy to answer any questions that come up. There's obviously been some big changes when it comes to neighborhood relations, and it looks like that on the surface. But when you look at what I see happening, I think that you're going to see that it's really a lot of continuation of the things that we've done within regards to providing services to the NIAs and so forth. My decision was that in order to do some efficiencies, we needed to make some changes. And one of those was to do some reorganization and eliminating the actual Department of Neighborhood Relations and moving those pieces under different directors. And so made the decision to eliminate the director and made the decision to move the housing part underneath planning, to move the property maintenance part underneath the police department, and then to move community engagement staff underneath the city manager. I felt that in that last move with moving community engagement underneath my office, it would give an opportunity to actually be able to hopefully streamline the lines of communication related to items and things that might be important to the neighborhoods, and that Monique would, and her staff would continue to be the conduit that the neighborhoods would rely on for their communication. And then basically, but with Monique being someone that reports directly underneath me, that provides a greater communication ability. Her and I will be talking more often than we've ever in the past with that set up. And I think there's opportunity there. In addition to that, as the discussion went last night at the governing body meeting, there are desires to have more or less an ombudsman position within the city. I've been looking at that. That is by no means fully developed. We have a long ways to go to get that all planned out. But that is, I think, a reasonable goal that we need to be able to provide something that's more responsive to our citizens and in turn, of course, our neighborhoods. Well, that already exists, but just ensuring that that's the case. And then also, in a way, realizing that if there's something that's going on that you feel isn't being handled by that staff, knowing that the next step is to me and that my information will be available and I would be available to take those calls and deal with an issue that you may have. So I guess I'm going to stop there. I know I received some questions. I think James forwarded them from Margo. I can either let Margo ask them and then I'll respond, or however we want to handle that. Be happy to work through that. And then I'm here until you guys are done asking.
City Manager, this is Margo. Good evening.
Hi.
Yes, I sent some questions, and I'm happy to read them if you would prefer. I read them from my phone, so just kind of bear with me. Do you want me just...
Well, I can read them. I have them sitting in front of me.
Okay, that's fine. However you want to do that.
Okay, yeah. So these questions came from Margo, and I think they're questions that others probably are wondering regarding an answer on. And the first question was, what was the rush in reduction of the empowerment grant and why wasn't the CAC notified? Well, I'm not exactly sure how I can, the process of notification that went to the CAC, but I can tell you that the decision related to making a reduction was made rather quickly, and probably just say, in a way, it was definitely unilateral. I mean, I looked at what recommendation staff was looking at for projects that they wanted to pursue as we looked at money we had available for various projects. And we looked at the empowerment grant as being an area where we had not, I guess, looked at as many projects recently. And so I thought there was an opportunity that we could reduce the amount of funding there. And there was a strong push related to the housing study that we look at weatherization. And we were running short on time and probably made the decision in a vacuum, admittedly. But we made a decision that we had to submit something to the budget in order to move it forward, realizing fully that the decisions such as this would have to be approved by the governing body in order to be able to be moved forward. So there would be opportunity for discussion to occur over the next few months once it was proposed. And so that was the reason, and bottom line is it was about timing related to how fast it happened and why people weren't notified or consulted. So and I'll take that as something that just occurred and is based on that. You have a follow-up?
I do. And I'm just trying to give other people an opportunity. I know that the housing study was presented or provided to us via email, and I'm not going to beat this, but I know it was either January or around February. So that's why I ask when this decision was made, because I don't feel that the housing study was presented to us in ample time you know, it caught us off guard. It blindsided us. We didn't have any input for that. And so I guess that's where I'm at with that. I'm just looking at why wasn't the housing study presented to us sooner? Different things like that. Why was it delayed to let us know?
Well, and I think, you know, there are a lot of people that have been involved in the housing study, and it's probably over 20 people and all of that input. I think that it was looked at as that organization represented a cross-section of the community, so therefore they had the right recommendations and understanding of what was needed in the area of housing. And so we were looking at that as being something that was appropriate based on the information that it was provided to me and how the housing study was going and its preliminary factor. For me, felt like it was the right decision, that we've been talking a lot about trying to help fix our housing, and this was a small way that we could do so. It was never that empowerment would go away completely. I didn't want to do that, and so that's why we split the funding between $60,000 for empowerment and $77,000 for weatherization.
This is Teresa Miller. What I don't understand is Community Action already has a weatherization program, so I don't know why we're duplicating that. But on the housing study, one thing they did not look at, and I have this problem in my NIA, and I think part of Oakland has the same problem. I don't think they've ever addressed it because they haven't done any work in that area down by the Santa Fe shops, that federal money cannot be used down by railroads because of the sound problem. So when I got the SWRC grant, I could not use any funding to help those people redo their homes because they live too close to the railroad. So, and that has never been brought up in the housing section. So until we handle that, how are we going to help those people? Because that's where most of my help for fixing houses needs to come from, is the area that I can't put the funding in.
Well, if you look at what we're looking at doing is the Housing Trust Fund, when we put some seed money in from the city, the hope is that the private sector is going to come along. There are already banks that have talked about community dollars that they need to put to somewhere within the community per their, you know, their laws or their rules. And so they've talked about putting in money. That money wouldn't have the same restrictions that the federal side would have related to that. And the same is true, and I know that's something that's they're dealing in East Topeka North, is the issue of the floodplain. There's also restrictions in how many homes can actually receive this home renovation money based on the fact that some of these homes are in the flood area and can't receive the grant money. So you're right, we do have an issue, but the hope is that the private dollars would help to be able to help projects along those lines that won't qualify for federal dollars.
Okay. So here's also something I heard. I heard you say that you didn't want to take the empowerment grant away, but that's what's happened. We got the sort, but the empowerment grant, as far as we understand, is gone.
No, there's $60,000 that was allocated in the budget for empowerment type activities. And what those programs look like in the end and how they move forward, we can still address. There was $60,000 that I put in the budget towards empowerment grants. And I know that there were various programs that were talked about, but the actual final, what that $60,000 would be used for, when I did the budget, was still there for NIAs to apply for. So,
but the structure of the old neighborhood empowerment grant program, as we all came to know it, is gone.
Well, I guess that's what was proposed. But if that's not, I mean, I think that's what Monique proposed with the various other types of projects. But if those aren't going to be effective, then I'm willing to take a look at maybe we need, you know, to go back to something else. So I'll take that input and we can work with staff to figure out, especially when we haven't done anything as it relates to accepting applications for empowerment. You know, we didn't do that this year. The other thing is that the last night, out of the blue, I ended up with a motion, and it got approved for doing neighborhood initiative program, which is $200,000, which is supported by the governing body and decided on that now we're going to have a $200,000 fund that's going to have similar type activities to what Empowerment had. And so there's now a new opportunity, which we don't even know how we're going to structure yet. I mean, we went from doing $137,000 for Empowerment type activities, me reducing it to 60, to now having the governing body come back and say they want to do $200,000 worth of neighborhood initiatives. So there, as I said, I proposed it because I thought that was a direction that needed to go. But in the end, the governing body's made a decision that that's not the right way. So now we're going to have something different. And it's brand new. We just got it approved last night. I don't know what the structure is going to look like, but I can tell you that the way it was approved, it's going to be things similar to what we're used to seeing in neighborhood empowerment grants. So that is going to be worked out and will be available to you once we get it all figured out on what the
application. Well, here's my suggestion moving forward on that, because all of that sounds good. And I'm certainly encouraged by the city committing additional funds for the area. But now that we know that the city's governing body has made that a priority, my suggestion moving forward, since we haven't even started to look at how that might shake out, is that we get citizens involved in the process now.
Sure.
So that then we can all be at the same table at the same time, working on those challenges and making decisions about how that program's going to look.
Yeah, I think that should be a great item for your next meeting, your next agenda. What do you want to see out of what was proposed? We have to figure out exactly how the funding is going to come, because it's going to basically come from three pots. It's going to come from capital improvement money that would normally be in SORT. It's going to come from the empowerment grant money that was available through the CDBG, and then whatever general fund money we can. And so I don't know exactly how much is going to be available. There are going to be some restrictions, but we're going to take money that was allocated for SORT and allocated for empowerment in my budget and merge those together and come up with what types of projects we can fund based on those types of funding that we have. And then you guys can give us the input as to what that makes the most sense.
Sure. And being at the same table at the same time,
sure,
working on those challenges.
You bet.
I also have a question of the two grants that we have out there that the girls came up with leaves a lot of NIAs out. Are we still going to go with those grants? Because it basically lets five NIAs that have been the last five SORT grant people that received funds are the only ones that really can apply for these things. So the rest of us cannot.
Well, that's really, we're starting over, Teresa. I mean, this is no longer going to be what was originally planned by me or anyone.
Okay.
This is a whole different program, but it will have components of programs that we've seen in the past, if you understand.
All right. Also, I kind of like to have a promise from you that in the past, when people have called the city manager's office, and this, I hear this from people that call me complaining, that they do not get a response from your office, and that they would like to speak with your office to go over things, but it's not happening. So can we have an open door that way?
Yeah, the thing that I'll tell you is my day's pretty packed. So the best way, I'll talk with you, but oftentimes it has to get scheduled. So if you get on my schedule, I'll talk with you. But calling up out of the blue and saying, I need to talk to City Manager Trout, you're rolling dice as to whether I'm going to be available. And I know most of you, and if you call me and I'm available, I'm going to take your call. Even if we're having a bad day, I'm going to take your call and we're going to talk it out. But oftentimes I'm tied up in other meetings and other things that have been scheduled weeks ago. And so I can't do as often, I can't promise you I can do a hey you call. But if you call up, and my new assistant's name is Luann Davis, she's been with me almost 6 months now. She's very good. If you tell her you want to talk, she will check with me. I'll say, yeah, I know you, schedule a call, and we'll schedule a call and we'll talk about whatever's going on.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, before we get too much farther, Susan had a question. What is the dollar amount goal for private investors to contribute? And this was something that the that the city manager touched on earlier.
Yeah, I can't, I don't think we've set a goal yet, but I think if I remember right, when we initially approved the Housing Trust Fund, Wendy Wells from U.S. Bank came forward, and I believe she said she had over $300,000 that she has to commit to community-type activities every year. So now, she may not give it all to the Housing Trust Fund, but there is a significant amount of money from year over year that they're investing in the community per their guidelines, and per their generosity that they do. So, you know, I don't know what our goal is yet, because we got to figure out the what we're going to pursue. There's that steering committee, council members, there'll be CAC members on that housing commission. I would call it, it's an ad hoc housing committee. so
we're NIA members too?
Well, they came from the CAC, so I would assume that they are.
Well, I'm not on the CAC, but I'm an officer in my NIA.
Okay, well, I'm not exactly sure how they were chosen, but I know through Corey and through Bill, they were able to, they were selecting people that were citizens that could be on the committee, and I think they went through the CAC, but I can verify that with Bill exactly who that is. But yes, they will be involved in that discussion to finalize what our housing goals and priorities should be, looking at the near term, midterm, long term, and how we're going to pursue that. So that's what the next step is over the next, we got about, I'd say about 105 days left in our 120, with the first meeting scheduled August 24th, to start breaking this housing study down and getting the priorities established that we want to move forward with. And the goal is the middle of November, we're going to be presenting to the governing body what the recommendations are. And then at the same time, we're looking at the con plan for the next 5 years and how that plays into the housing study and the recommendations that we have there. So we're not going to approve the con plan until this housing group gets done. And right now, it looks like right now we have a schedule for both of those things to be approved in the same night, because they are going to be tied together in certain ways. Because of the amount of money that we get from HUD that relates to housing, we really need to make sure and that we don't approve the con plan prior to figuring out what the housing priorities are, so that we get those two mixed together, because it's a lot of money over 5 years that will be invested through HUD on our housing side.
Well, put me down for that, because I want to be involved in that.
I don't know that we were doing more members, Michael, but I will find out.
All right. Can we move to the next question? I'm trying to be respectful of everybody's time.
Sure. So there was a question, is why was the CAC told by Director Wright on June 17th that the Consolidated Action Plan decision due date was required to be made by the CAC in the next 30 days from the date presented and not informed of the extension date to December 31? Why did the CAC learn about this extension at a council meeting? Do we have time to suggest program enhancements considering the December 31, 2020 extension? Well, it's not really an extension. And well, December 31, 2020 is actually when we have to have it approved and submitted to HUD. That's our final date that we have to have our 21 through 25 plan submitted. It's been history that, what I've been told, it's been history that the con plan has always been approved at the same time that the budget is. And that was where we were doing, that's what we were doing. Corey got it ready and it was going to be proposed at the same time as the budget. Councilwoman Hiller decided that she made a recommendation that we not do that because of the housing issues. And so it was a surprise to me that we weren't approving the con plan in August as well. It wasn't just, it was a surprise to everyone. In the end of the day, they requested it and their request made sense. We shouldn't be approving that until we do the other part. And so yes, there is definitely opportunity for you to continue to make comments and recommendations, study it. We've got till the middle of November, that's our plan right now, to when we'll bring the con plan back. And if we're not ready in the middle of November, we can do it in December, but my preference is that we should know what that con plan is going to be based on when the housing part gets done as well. Any follow-ups on that? Okay. Next question that Margo had was, what is the percentage of CDBG HUD funds that are given directly to the CAC? In reality, there's really, yes, Margo?
I didn't mean CAC. I meant NIA. I apologize. Oh,
okay. So I will have to go back and get that number.
Okay. I apologize.
Yeah, that's fine. But I do have a bit of a breakdown in some of the things
Okay. Right
now.
Thank you.
The city anticipates receiving $1.2 million in CDBG funding, $495,000 in home funding, that's the housing rehab stuff, for 21. And that can be used for programming in the LMI neighborhoods. The neighborhood-based programming includes SORT housing, that's $318,000 for the SORT housing. The empowerment program was set at 60, and the NIA support at $65,000. So directly to the NIA, it's $65,000 as the support funds. This total goes to $443,000, or 26% of our CDBG programmable funds. The remainder goes towards programs that directly benefit LMI households. So I kind of got you most of an answer. It's $65,000 is the NIA support. And of course, divided among the 20 some NIAs. Okay. The last question you had was, what is the percentage of CDBG HUD funds that are given directly to the CAC? Well, it's, that's the wrong one. Oh, what is the last time programs funded by CDBG HUD were evaluated by the CAC? We don't know for sure. I mean, it's HUD monitors us on a regular basis and audits us. But when you guys looked at it, would probably be each time when you give input on the consolidated action plan discussion each year. So
I guess here's my thing. HUD is really, I mean, they're really unaware of the projects that we have. You know, in determining what is necessarily sufficient. I mean, are they coming down? Do we have someone that's looking at them? I mean, I realize that are we sending information? And then who is checking that information? I think that kind of goes back to where I mentioned about performance measures.
Well, we have, I mean, I'm not the one that submits them, but I know that we have obligations to submit information every year to HUD. Okay. Now, when it comes to, and somebody can correct me, I can verify with HUD myself, but what I've seen from HUD information is there is no requirement for us to give any money to the NIAs for support. That is a decision that we've done. So it could be zero that we give NIAs. Now, I'm not advocating that. I'm just telling you that is, there is no requirement in HUD for us to give NIA support money.
Well, I guess my thing is that I'm looking at, because, you know, I'm going to, let me just say this, bear with me, please. I'm talking about existing projects. So when I say that, I want performance measures on those. I want to know how successful we are. Are we meeting the needs of our community? I assume that I don't know. I mean, HUD, I don't know that they're an enforcer to necessarily come out and check our programs, other than if we're checking off a checklist that we're meeting that. And I've seen some information that we supply to HUD. But my thing again, are we meeting the sufficient needs of the challenges that our community is faced with? You know, shelter plus care. What is the, how long are people actually being assisted with that? Are things going on that need to be going on with shelter plus care? Do we have issues of people selling drugs? Are there facilities or where they're living? Or is it safe? I mean, well, I'm questioning.
Yeah. Shelter plus care is, I mean, from my understanding is every year we spend all of the money. I mean, at the end of the year, the the individuals that qualify for rental assistance are provided rental assistance. And at the end of the year, we usually run out. And we're monitoring. We received money back, it was a year and a half ago, we started doing the Housing First program for homeless people. And so we've been able to utilize Shelter Plus Care money that we had available that wasn't allocated, and got it out there and helped people get in homes. And so we've done, in Shelter Plus Care, I believe, a good job. I mean, I signed every contract for Shelter Plus Care comes to me, and that's, you know, names of just average people that are getting help to get into a home. And every one of those homes has to meet a certain set of guidelines, and there's a set of, in the contract, it says specifically what they're required to meet. And we have people on our staff, inspectors, that go out and check to make sure the homes are good. Now, I can't tell you that someone in one of those homes isn't using drugs. I mean, you don't know for sure, but we're setting them up for the opportunity to be in a home. And the guidelines are that they have a nice home or apartment, whatever.
I wanted to jump in here real quickly regarding the issues of NIAs and there not being any kind of federal requirement to fund them, and yet they are specifically designated, at least as far as I can remember, and I've worked on a number of con plans in the past, NIAs are listed, as is the CAC, as citizen participation vehicles. And sure, so sure. While there may not be a specific HUD guideline that says that there's funding available for those groups, certainly there are HUD guidelines pertaining to citizen participation and comment and encouraging that kind of thing. And that's one, of course, one of the functions of the NIAs and the CAC.
Well, definitely the function that you have. And, you know, it's the way the organization's set up for the NIAs and the CAC to provide information and feedback back to us and to be involved. And more involved, the better. I think I've seen that in different NIAs. Some are more involved than others are as far as their organization and helping to, you know, and that goes back and forth as time goes on. But, you know, the obligation, my understanding is the obligation for CDBG money is it's supposed to be spent on low to moderate income programs. And so.
Which would necessarily include.
Right.
Communication and yeah, getting the word out and all of right, those things.
So this is how we've structured it here. And it's been, I don't know for sure how long, it was well before my time that you guys structured it this way with the NIAs and the CAC. And it's been in place for a long time. I, you know, as far as if the structure needs to be different, then that's input that we need to receive. So I guess that's part of listening.
Really, really quickly, before we get too far down the list again, there was another, in the comments section, there was another question from Donna Ray. And it is there a list of people on that committee? And I'm assuming that she means for the housing committee. So I will.
Well, I.
Kidding me, Andrea, can you ask a question? If you go to the Topeka.org webpage and put in housing study, it takes you to the housing study page. I'm looking at it right now. On the bottom of the page is a list of all committee members, steering committee members. Okay.
Then there were others that were added to the steering committee that we've added. Some of the project sponsors that weren't on the, you know, they're not part of the steering committee. Affordable housing providers, Greater Topeka Partnership, one more staff person, and then the CAC, your organization, Landlord Association. We're looking, trying to get the banks involved. Our financial institutions involved. Right now, we have the potential there's 30 people that's going to be involved in this. So it's going to be a large group. It's going to be interesting to see how we can manage through it, but trying to make sure we get a cross-section of everywhere. You know, and a lot of those people that are on that steering committee are people that are involved in providing housing and you know, like Trey George from Topeka Housing Authority and so on. So
have we got all the questions that have been sent in answered yet?
Yes.
Okay. Here's a question for you, and this is really a concern to me. They're changing up how we do code compliance. We're putting it back to the police department. It's been there before, and what worries me is that we had a code compliance committee that worked together for a long time. We worked with Darren Scott, and I think her last name was Burkhart, and we took it away from the police department because it was too much for them, too much paperwork also, I was told. I know that the reason why it's being sent back to the police department is because they can access people's properties where a code compliance officer cannot. They can only look, but the problem is code compliance right now is not working. You can go around in my area and it's just really bad, and I understand that the virus had a lot to do with some of it, but it's been this way for a long time. But my main concern is putting it back to the police department is not really a good deal, because we had major problems when the police department handled it the last time. Things were not getting done. The paperwork wasn't getting done. And the other part of code compliance that has never, ever been fixed, and we have worked on it, we worked on it till we were just beating our heads on the table, is that when your code compliance when they write up someone, it goes all through the procedures, all the letters and everything, goes just like it's supposed to. But when it goes to the court system, it gets tied up in the court system. I have got two over here. One of them has been going on 6 years. One is going on 2 to 3 years. And they just sit there, and they are eyesores, and they bring out everybody else's property down. And there's no reason for the one that's been there for 6 years to still be going on. They let this guy just run over him, and it's just crazy. And when it first was in Bill Filander was helping us with this, and then it got out of his hands. There's no answers. Nobody wants to do anything with these properties that are eyesores to other people. So we've got these things sitting in court system, and they're not getting moved out like they're supposed to be. They're not sticking to their guns and say, you've got so many days to do this and so many days to do that, or this is what's going to happen. They just let these people come back and come back and come back, and that's got to stop. So my main concern is we need to fix it where it goes to the court system, and I'm really scared about it going back to the police department, because I remember the nightmare when it was at the police department. Because they really don't have time to do code compliance and to write all that stuff up. They really need to be on our street protecting the people.
Well, here's where I want to correct Teresa. Mike Haugen is still running that division. So, and that's not going to change until Mike decides he wants to retire or whatever. But Mike is still there and still running that division. The police department, from my discussions with Chief Cochran, they are going to have a person that oversees, as a supervisor for Mike. But for the most part, Mike is going to run his division like he's been running it when he was under Sasha, or, doing his action. The police department will not be interfering with him doing his work. And if I hear about that, then I'll step in, because they need to still basically act. That's where they're being housed, but their purpose is different than the police department. And I intend to try and continue to make it forward. And as far as those cases, if you want to drop me a note, I can review what's going on with those cases. I can tell you, though, we're in a bit of state of a flux, because Coran has moved over to be the new municipal judge, and we don't have a prosecutor right now, and so things are going to go a little slower out of prosecution until I get a new prosecutor hired.
Okay. Right, I understand. Because the one that was there for 6 years, I even went to court and sat in on it. And of course, the judge wouldn't let me talk, which I understand. I talked to the attorney that was handling it for the city, and the things that they were letting this guy get away with, I just did not understand the procedure. And when I asked my co-compliance guy, that sits there every time this case comes up, he comes back and we ask for a report on that case. Well, I don't know. Well, you should know. You're sitting right there in the room. What are you doing? Not listening? So that's frustrating to the neighbors, to the neighborhood, because we know that our code compliance guys have to show up when some of these guys go to court.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not getting a report back.
Well,
so it's really frustrating to us on that end also. Okay. So, yeah, but that's what we've been told, that it was going to go to police department, and this gives the police department access to our properties, which has made a lot of people uneasy.
No, because we're going to continue to have the code inspectors are going to still be the same code inspectors or same type of job. They should not be accessing. They won't have the same authority as a law enforcement officer. I think it'll work better in some ways, because sometimes a code enforcement officer goes out and the real problem is it's a junk vehicle that's sitting in the street. Well, the code enforcement guys won't write that. That's the police department's responsibility.
Right.
Now, Mike Haugen can go and talk to his boss and say, hey, boss, I need a black and white to go out and write this car up. And I think that it has the opportunity, if done right, to be better for the neighborhood. I mean, time will tell. This is brand new. It just happened at the beginning of last month. And so we've got a little ways to go. And it happened 1 month ago that everybody moved over to where they were reassigned to. And there are still things happening within the transition that we still haven't all the way worked through. So time will tell, but that I believe is going to be a better situation if handled correctly. And so I appreciate your warnings that you're giving, Teresa. It gives me things to look for as time goes on and to listen for. And so I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I would like to just touch on a couple of things. I'm waiting for a text back from Dawn. She asked a question about, will this breakdown be made available to the CAC? I'm not exactly sure what breakdown she's talking about, so I'm giving her a little bit of time to reply.
Those numbers that I rattled off regarding HUD funds.
Let
me go to that email that I got that information from staff on, and I can send it to you, James.
And while you're looking at that, I just wanted to make a quick comment and clarification on my part. I am on the housing committee right now, and I just wanted to the steering committee, and I just wanted to say that, you know, this is my personal perspective of it from sitting on it. It was more of a sit and listen to what the consultants had to say as opposed to a steering committee. And, you know, quite frankly, I feel like if we're going to do steering committees, then maybe that steering committee should be involved on, hey, are we going to hire a consultant or are we going to listen to the community at large, or put out something. And like I said, I just didn't really feel like the steering committee did much steering. They did a lot more listening.
James, this next step, it will be a collaboration. The consultant won't even be involved. We may ask him a question or two, and we're doing that to get prepared for this, but he's not going to be involved in these meetings, as far as I know. We're done with that side, other than occasional questions we may have for him. This is truly about getting the input from the steering committee and those others that we've added to it, to this group, to figure out where we go from here with the recommendations that they gave us in the housing study.
Well, again, I wanted to follow up a little bit on what James just talked about, but before doing that, I want to reiterate that I want to be a part of that moving forward. The consultant study felt to me, the housing study, kind of felt like a consultant's study to me, and I think some of what James has said in his comments there tends to point to that conclusion. There was a public meeting that was held in February in the first floor conference room there at the Holiday Building. I attended, as did some other people, I think, on this call. it was my hope at that point then that there would be other meetings that would involve the public as well in the creation of the housing study. That was the only meeting that there was. And I read the housing study, and I can't say with any great degree of satisfaction, even though it was just the one meeting, I don't think anything that was discussed from the standpoint of the public attendees made it into the housing study. And so I definitely think we need to revisit the housing study to be sure. The thing that Teresa talked about earlier with the difficulty of doing housing close to railroads, that's an issue that the public could have brought into those discussions then, but that didn't happen.
Well, you need to look at what the housing study is too. The housing study was a very technical study related to the types of housing that we have available, the types of housing that we need based on our population, our incomes, types of housing that we need related to, do we need apartments? Do we need single family homes? You know, what is the history? Do we need communal living? That was a very technical part of that study. And then it listed all of the various potential options that you could have in order to accomplish the types of housing that were short. And so there was a lot of technical part to that related to the project. And if you look, there's something for everyone across every socioeconomic sector of the city is in that plan, recognizing where our needs are based on each of those sectors and the strategies in order to help with that and help keep people in their homes and other types of things. So it was very comprehensive. And if your particular suggestion wasn't in there, but it's a very complex study of what we need.
Well, but I'm not willing to concede, even if that's true, that there weren't things that the public could not contribute that would be consistent with that study. I just don't see the connection between the two. There were policy recommendations within that study, and certainly there was information that regular people could have contributed to that, and that should have happened, I think, to a greater degree.
James, this is Ivan. I attended almost all of those meetings for the housing study. I was on the steering committee, and I agree with Mr. Trout that it was a very complex study, and it was done at the request of the city, and they did what we asked them to do. It may not have included every complaint from individual people that had something to say, smirking or not, it did touch almost every facet of housing in this community. A much better job than we had quite a few years ago when I sat on a similar committee. So I was happy with what was done. The next part may have some place to include the individual complaints, but is a much broader look at what needs to happen in our community from one end to the other than just here's a thing that we need to fix. So,
well, Ivan, what?
wait, I'm not done. I think if you want to ask Mr. Fyander if you can join that committee, that would be fine. But to demand to be on it just because your demands have not been met, that's a little presumptuous on your part.
And that's a complete mischaracterization of why I want to be involved.
Thank you.
Complete mischaracterization.
I agree with Mike.
Of course.
Ooh.
Stay classy there, Ivan.
All right, guys. So we're not going to get into the personal realm of things. Look, I respect both of you, and I respect both of your opinions. If you guys need to have a conversation outside of the CAC meeting, by all means, feel free to do so. However, we do have some other questions that Margot has raised possibly? Still, Mr. Trout, yes or no?
Hey, James, this is Donald. You said that you're a member of that committee. Are there any other CAC members that were notified about possible membership to that committee?
So I was on that committee, and I believe Ivan was as well. And I was asked to be on that committee by Sasha. She was still there, and I accepted that. I believe, Ivan, were you a CAC representative on that or no?
I'm sorry, state your question, please.
On the housing study committee, were you a, somebody has their volume on and there's like TV or something in the background. Uh-huh. Can you please mute that? All right, thank you. Ivan, my question to you was, I was asked to be on the steering committee for that because I was the CAC co-chair, and I believe I was the acting chair at the time, directly by Sasha. I know you were also on that committee. Were you on there as a CAC member, or were you on there as something else? Because if you weren't another CAC member that was on that committee, then I do not believe that there was another CAC member on that committee.
Well, the easy answer for me is it was both. I was a member of the CAC, and I am a representative for housing in this community. So I don't separate them. But yes, I was asked as a CAC member.
Does that answer your question, Donald?
Yes, that answered the question. All right, thank you.
So I'm sorry to hop back and forth, but when we're talking about rehousing the code compliance at the police station, are they still going to have their own phone number? Or will they need to be called through the non-emergent line as if we were calling police?
A good question. They actually, it's a very good question. I didn't cover that. All of the staff that was neighborhood relations is going to continue to be housed and have the same phone numbers that they currently do. In other words, they're all still going to be in the Holiday Building. Monique and I, right now, City Hall is going to have some renovations that are going to, some minor renovations that are going to happen in it coming up and later this month. There are not offices in this building for Monique's staff to come over at this time. It's probably going to be 5 or 6 months before we're in a position for them to even consider moving over here. And we need to get more handle on what that's going to look like. And then we'll decide whether some or part of Monique's staff actually comes over here, or that it's best for them to stay where they're at. They're very accessible where they're at now. It should be all the same numbers, should continue to work, and you shouldn't really notice a change other than their ability to pass things on to me if there's a need.
Okay. I was just asking because I know that we've given out those numbers to various members of our communities. So.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You brought that up. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Well, and you may not all have seen, Margo asked if I would come on a quarterly basis to your meeting and talk, and I'd be happy to. This is something that I need to improve on, and I'm going to make that commitment. It was there initially, but, you know, things get busy and you let things slide. And so making that commitment again to try and, be here on a quarterly basis, you let me know if it's the last month of the quarter, you want me there each quarter, let me know what it is, and whatever meetings you let me know, and I'll put them on the schedule.
I did have one more question. Are we going to have time for that, or?
Yes, I believe we will have time for one more question, as long as it's kept to a reasonable time frame.
Okay.
And then I do have one final statement that I will make after you ask your question, Mr. Bell.
Okay. And in hearing the explanation about things not changing with property maintenance being placed under the police department, and also reading your letter saying that essentially the housing department is not going to change as far as staff and what it's doing, and community engagement is not going to change as far as staff and what it's doing. I guess from a macro standpoint, I'm still trying to understand if all of those things are true, and maybe I'm misreading that, but if all of those things are true, then why was it necessary to break up the department?
Well, I can tell you that I had a lot of direction from the governing body that we needed to look at whether or not we had the right structure within our city. And when you look at that department, there were a number of examples of where those things could be done, especially as I looked at housing services. That could be done underneath planning. A lot of the things that are being done with the housing study, Bill Finder has been involved in those intimately, and getting what's happening there coordinated with what's happening in housing services, I thought would be a benefit. The history that it had been under PD made sense. And then I have a need that identified, especially since, as I've gone forward without now a deputy city manager, getting some help over in my office to help cover down, and the ability to utilize Monique's past experience to be able to be an ombudsman, and her staff that are already communicating with many people in the community. I thought that that would be a benefit for the whole city, and continue to keep support there for the NIA. So for me, it was an opportunity. It saved, you know, it was a director's position of $150,000. You know, we're constantly evaluating whether we're at the right staffing levels. So for me, this was the first step. And whether there's other changes that need to occur related to staffing, those will be made as we get each director to evaluate the staff that they have underneath them with the new additions to their staff, and whether they're the right amount, and whether they are doing the right functions. And so, you know, there might be additional changes, but for now, this change is enough. And we have the savings that existed there. And so then, you know, there may be more changes that come in the future, but it's let's see how this works first and see what the issues are, and then we can consider those.
This is Teresa. I got one comment to make. What scares me is when we put this under Bill Finder, I had a situation where we had told Bill that our NIA did not want anything next to our residentials or anything. We gave him rules of what we wanted to follow in our NIA. He went against them in the last property that wanted to change up and change their zoning and change a whole bunch of stuff. And we fought him tooth and nail, and they just ignored our rules. And so I'm hoping that he will listen better to the NIAs than he has in the past.
Okay. A point taken, and obviously that goes back to I'm Bill's supervisor as well. So
all right, since we are on the subject of Bill, and we are on the subject of, or we have been on the subject of the Housing Steering Committee, I think late last week, and I was going to bring this up anyway, but this seems like a great time to do it. Mr. Finder is looking for a couple of more CAC representatives for this housing study. If anyone is interested, in that, please send me an email, and I will forward that email to Mr. Finder and let him make the final decision on that, because I don't feel like that is a decision that I should be making. Is that fair to everyone?
Yes.
All right. Do we have any more questions, comments, or concerns for Mr. Kraut or for the general body? No? Okay. If that's the case, then I would like to make a motion that we adjourn our meeting.
I second it.
All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say aye. All right, it sounds like we have an adjournment. It's really hard to hear everybody at the same time saying aye. I think I heard five or six of them.
Yep, I think the meeting is adjourned.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your time. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks.